This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Sabre wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, a sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
Presented by Basic Tipton. Now, here's Mike Penna.
And good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network, all presented by our friends at Phasic Tipton. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, flying solo on Trainer Talk here tonight. My usual entry mate, the pontiff of the pick four, Jude Feld, not able to make it here this evening, but what a show we have on tap over the course of the next hour. We do want to welcome everybody just joining us coast to coast on Sirius 93. And for those of you who have been with us over the course of the past 3 hours with our live racing coverage on XM 209, welcome back to the program. And as always, a very special welcome to everybody joining us around the world on our website, horseracingradio.net. A couple of great trainers coming your way over the course of the next hour. Bruce Brown is going to help kick things off in the first half of the show, and then we'll be joined by trainer Merrill Shearer in the second half. So a lot of things to get to here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. And without further ado, we welcome in Bruce Brown, the man who has trained 316 winners. He has accumulated purse earnings in excess of $11 million and counting, a native of Maryland, based in New York now, and he is with us on Trainer Talk to kick things off on this Wednesday evening. Bruce, welcome to the show.
I'm glad to be here. Glad to be with you.
Yeah, I mentioned being a native of Maryland, now based in New York. I'm sure you're very familiar with racing there in the mid-Atlantic states. Being around your older brother, Steve, who was also a trainer. Take us back to the beginning and tell us how Bruce Brown got involved with horse racing.
Yeah, my brother Steve, like you mentioned, he's my older brother. He's actually 20 years in between us. He's the first, he's number one, and I'm number seven out of 10. So that was just always, since as long as I can remember, I just always wanted to do what my big brother did. I worked as a young, when I was really young, I'd always, go spend time with him in the summers at Penn National. And my grandparents were there also. So when I'd go to see them, I would stop off and always help out my brother a little bit. And that's kind of how it all got going. Never lost the love for the horses and the love for the game.
Yeah, we've heard a lot of trainers on the show talk about when they were young and they were growing up and they were just getting involved. They had somebody like you had with your brother Steve that they could look up to and that they could, kind of idolize in that respect and learn from. And a lot of them have told us that they were more concerned with being at the racetrack than they were with being in school or anything like that. They were reading the racing form in class. Was that kind of your background as well?
Yeah. It's, I don't know if that's a good example to be passing on to the younger ones nowadays. But I learned how to read a racing form. That's kind of how I learned how to read pretty much. And my grandparents and my father, even everybody was just through my brother. Everybody was involved in the game. So it was always around. And I guess there definitely could have been worse things to be getting into, but the horses pretty much, that's all. When I was a teenager, that was my only, my only focus, and didn't really help my schoolwork much, but at least now it seems like it's paid off. It's all worked out here in the end, so.
Yeah, looking at the way things have turned out, you've been very successful. You haven't been doing this for all that long, but you've been extremely successful, and we're going to talk a little bit about that as we move over the course of the next 20 minutes or so. But it had to be a huge advantage for you, looking back on it now, growing up in a racing family, that had to be a huge advantage to get you to where you are today.
Yeah, and I think the biggest thing was I never, even though I had my brother, and then he, you know, when I moved on and I worked for John Forbes and with Dale the Cat, my brother, his first job was with John Tamaro, who was, and then John Forbes was his assistant at that time. So, you know, even that opened up doors for me. But I think the biggest thing was, you know, they never handed me anything. You know, I think nowadays, you know, a lot of people in this game, you know, a lot of people think it's, you know, they just kind of get the easy way and don't have to work for it. They think just because they're kind of born into it that they don't have to pay their dues. But I still slept in many a tack room and slept on many a bale of straw, you know, because it was almost, my brother almost had the attitude where, you know, he almost in the early stages, he didn't want me involved because he knows that it's a tough game and it's a hard, you know, it can be a hard living. Yeah, so he almost did a lot of things to discourage me, but I think that only made me kind of want it more in the long run. So.
Yeah, and I'm sure he didn't cut you any breaks. I'm the older brother. I have a younger brother, and I know any time that I have the chance to get involved in something with him, I'm not cutting him any breaks. And I'm sure that was probably the same situation with Steve.
Yeah. And you know, I'm glad that he was. You know, I'm glad it was that way. I mean, him and his and my sister-in-law Shelley, you know, they made me work in those early years. But that's I wouldn't have wanted it any other way. You know, like I said, that kind of made me love it more and want it more. So.
What were some of the things that you learned in working with him and growing up around it and his operation that you still kind of use when you're doing things today on your own?
A lot of it is just little things, just little horsemanship things that are, I think nowadays are kind of lost. You know, just basic barn etiquette and just being careful and, you know, knock on wood. I'm pretty thankful I've never been, you know, seriously hurt by a horse. Just, I think a lot of that is just from really being, you know, my brother came up around Maryland and back in those, and still, but really back in those days, I mean, just very good horsemen. And you just learn, you know, to respect the horses and just be careful. And that's the major thing. It's just all the little things that you kind of, you know, that you never forget. Like even, you know, when little things happen in the barn, you know, I can remember when my brother or my sister-in-law told me that when I was a kid, you know, watch this or don't do that or don't, you know, it's just accumulation of little things that really help you, you know, help you in the barn and help you as to be a better horseman. And I think a lot of that stuff is kind of lost nowadays. And I hope to kind of pass that on to people that work for me and pass that on to my, you know, to my kids.
Yeah, and you said that he really didn't want you to follow in his footsteps because he knew how difficult it was. When did he finally give in and give you his blessing?
I think right as soon as I finally graduated high school, you know, those were, you know, the high school days were kind of tough because I knew what I wanted to do, but, you know, my family was still, you know, back then, nowadays it's more so, you know, you have to go to college, but in my, you know, when I was in high school, it was still, you know, college was, you know, was definitely a, you know, a good thing, but back in those days, it wasn't so much like you have to go to college like it is now, but I definitely had to graduate high school. And then once I got out of high school and I turned 18, that's when he got me a job with John Forbes at Monmouth Park. And then once I went there, that was kind of then everything kept going from there.
Yeah, John Forbes, kind of a legend in New Jersey, always among the top trainers. Talk about going to work for John Forbes and what that was like in the early years.
Yeah, I mean, he with John, he still kind of started me off at the bottom. I went there and I was walking horses for him in at Mollet Park in the summer, which back, now it's lost a little bit of its, recently it's lost a little, still a great summer place to be, but back then it was really, the Jersey Shore was really just a great meet. You had a lot of young kids that had, summer jobs there at the track and stuff. So it was good. It was kind of a good place to go to for my first time and really being away from home. So that was, that was good. So I worked my way up with him and eventually I got the opportunity to be Tail the Cat's groom, and that was just a great, a great experience to be able to be around a horse like that and travel around, to the big races, got to go to Saratoga, for the first time and things like that. So.
Yeah, Tail the Cat turning into a pretty darn good sire as well. Of course, the sire of champion Gio Ponti. How much were you cheering for him to make it as a stallion after he retired?
Yeah, he was. Yeah, he was great. He was just very cool horse. Very cool horse to be around. And I had the pleasure of I was there when he got off the van as a 2-year-old, and I was there when he went to the breeding shed, at the end of his career. So it was good. It was a very good experience, and it was good to see John, have a horse of that caliber. And that's kind of why we all do this, is to hopefully be able to be around horses with horses like that, with that kind of ability.
And then did you go from John to working with Tim Hills after that?
Yeah, I went to work for Timmy. I had a string for him at Delaware, and then after that I took a string for him to New York, and that's kind of how I got settled in New York and been here ever since.
And I guess what was it, 2008? Is that when you ended up going out on your own?
January 2008 I went out on my own, and I've really been blessed and lucky to have some great owners along the way. My father-in-law, Billy Carroll, he's got our Sugar Bear stable. He was a big help getting me going, and had the great pleasure of working for a lot of, been very lucky, had a lot of good owners, and I've been very lucky up to this point.
Yeah, how difficult, or was it a difficult decision to go out on your own, or did you feel like you were just ready to do it?
Yeah, I had a few horses for my father-in-law that were still in Timmy's name, so I had some, I had some immediate horses that I would have, and I never could have imagined, things moving along so quickly, but it just all kind of fell into place. Whenever a new guy comes on the block and as far as, a new trainer, and they start winning some races, it just kind of snowballs, because every, owners are always looking for, looking for a new young, fresh face. So that's kind of how it got me going. I made a few good claims, got lucky on some claims. So that's how, early on just kind of snowballed and got me going.
Talking with trainer Bruce Brown on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. You mentioned claiming a couple of horses, and you've really, really made a name for yourself as a top player with those types of horses, with claiming horses. Talk about your program, Bruce, and your philosophy on finding and claiming the right horse to fit in with what you're trying to do and what you're trying to accomplish.
Yeah, I think a lot of times what I look for at first is just, a horse that has some conditions left where you can, have some opportunities to run them, run them in easier spots, to where maybe the previous outfit wasn't spotting them correctly, or, to try to get them in an easy spot where you can get the horse's confidence going. And it's not always, a lot of times a horse will just, will just do better with the change. It's not necessarily that it's a good change or you know, or an indifferent change. It's just any kind of, you know, if a horse has been in one routine for a long time, sometimes just any kind of change in that routine will kind of get them freshened up and get them moving in the right direction. You know, it's not always, you know, it's not always that you can say, oh, I did this, I did that. It's a lot of times it's what you don't do that might bring them around. Just kind of take it easy with them and just kind of let them reset. And I've you know, a lot of the better claims that we've made have, it's almost been just kind of don't do too much with them and just kind of let them come around on their own. And then those are some of the ones that have really thrived and then taken off.
Yeah, you've had a lot of successful claims. A couple that come to mind, Digger, who, of course, gave you your first stakes victory in New York in 2009 when he won the Gravesend Handicap at Aqueduct. And then Compliance Officer, one that a lot of people will never forget. And if I'm not mistaken, the 7-year-old is still in training, right?
Yeah, he's actually, we had a little at the end of last year. He had a little ankle injury, and we gave him the winter off down in Florida, and he was training back this spring great, just coming back better than ever, and he popped a splint on one of his front legs. So, you know, it took us a while to get him back going this year, and actually his first race back of the year was up in Saratoga, and then we ran him in the stake at Ashley Cole here at Belmont. So he's just had the two races. He'll run on showcase day, and he really seems like he had like a year off. So I think having the two races under his belt now, he's really coming back in, should be coming back into form. So I expect a good race out of him, and we'll probably keep running him right through the winter down in Florida, just because he's been so lightly raced this year. But he's actually something special. He's really, you never know, you know, he's as old as he is and that he's run as hard as he is. I mean, he's something else.
Yeah, not many people claim a horse and then get to run him in the Breeders' Cup Mile shortly after that, but you did that with Compliance Officer in 2011. Talk about a David and Goliath situation, though. That field included Goldakova and Gio Ponti, among others. That was a pretty salty race, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, and he didn't have the best trip. He had a wide post and never could really save any ground and never could really, you know, tuck in and relax. But yeah, that was a great experience. And then right after that, we came back, we went down to the fairgrounds and won the claiming crown. So I was glad to, you know, after the Breeders' Cup, you just worry about an experience like that and not running well with a horse that had been running so good. You just like to see them get back into form, and he bounced right back and won the claiming crown. So that was great.
Would that have been your most rewarding claim, Bruce, or was there another horse that you claimed and said, "Boy, we really did the right thing, picking up this horse as well"?
Yeah, he's right up there. And then for the same owner, Mr. Lamarca, we have Strong Impact, and he won a stake up in Saratoga, and he's, you know, he's of those two, you know, and just having, you know, being for Miss Lamarck, he really, you know, we make a good team, because he's very, you know, he's very up on the sheets and the, you know, the Ragusan sheets and the numbers and stuff like that. So, you know, he brings the horses to me, and then I go look at them and see how they look and that end of it. But we've made a pretty good team together. But those two are probably the top of the list, just because they've really done well since we've claimed them.
Yeah, there's always two sides to every coin, of course. Did you ever have a claim, I'm sure you probably did, where you said, "Wow, we really swung and missed on that one," though?
Yeah, no, we've definitely, it's, especially when, you know, with the kind of horses that Mr. Lamarca usually looks for. You know, he usually looks for horses that have some back class, and usually those are older, older campaigners. So it's it's kind of one of those cases where it's a lot of, you know, the risk reward. You know, I like to say with, you know, it seems recently with him, we either get a stake horse or we get a lawn, you know, we get a lawn ornament at his farm because, you know, it's either one or the other. They're either competing in stakes or they're retired. So, but, you know, I think the good ones that we've had gotten, and even Kingsford Drive, we've reclaimed up in Saratoga. I mean, he came right back, and I think he got 100 buyer the other day and a nice starter allowance, and then he's probably going to be punting for the claiming crown this year. But, you know, I think we've really done well. There's always going to be the bad ones, but you hope that the good ones make up for the bad ones, and at this point they definitely have, so.
Yeah, and I mentioned compliance officer being a 7-year-old. He's obviously a veteran runner. How much different is your approach with a horse like that and a stakes performer as opposed to a younger horse or a horse that's competing in the claiming ranks?
Well, the old veterans, you just kind of you more stay out of their way than anything. Just keep them happy. But as far as training wise, you just kind of you don't really have to do a whole lot. They know more about it than you do. You know, they've been through the ringer, and they know what to do. So you just kind of don't overdo it with them, and keep them happy, keep them fed well, and usually they'll reward you for it.
And you mentioned a couple of your clients that have kind of helped you get to the point where you are today. And I know that so many trainers that visit with us on the show are always grateful for those clients, because without them, they're not able to get to these levels. Who are some of those people, Bruce, outside of the ones you've already mentioned that have really helped you get to where you are?
Yeah, like I said, my father-in-law, he was a big help early on. And then I've had a lot of partnerships. I've tended to, you know, over the years, I've had a lot of, you know, syndicates and partnership stables. I had KCK Racing Stable early on. I had Rapoli there for a little bit. Mrs. Robsham, you know, that was great to work with some of those, some of her horses as 2-year-olds. And more recently, Epona Stable, they're a big group of people up in Saratoga that have really been a great help, and they're just, you know, they, up in Saratoga, when they win, it's just a great, you know, anytime you win a race in Saratoga, but especially people that are all up there and from Saratoga, you know, that's just always a great experience. Yeah, and then just trying to think of some more, like I said, Miss LaMarca, he's always been great. I got Al Gold now, and he's a great guy to have in my barn. You know, he's very he loves the action. He really puts up his money, and really likes to go after the better, you know, higher end horses. You know, so it's great to have somebody like that.
And I started off, Bruce, by talking about your 316 career wins, more than $11 million in purse earnings thus far, and that number obviously on the way up. What's on the Bruce Brown bucket list in terms of things that you want to accomplish moving forward?
Yeah, I mean, you always want to want to compete in greatest stakes and get, you know, and have success in those kind of races. I'm hoping to have a, you know, Spring to the Sky. He was third in the Woodford the other day at Keeneland, and then hopefully we'll be going on to the Breeders' Cup Turf Sprint with him. Strong Impact's will be in the Nearctic up in Canada this Sunday. So that's always the main thing, is just to always try to improve on your stock and compete in those kind of compete in those big races, because that's kind of what everybody does this for, is to to be there on the big days.
You know, when I called you to ask you to join us on the program, you had mentioned having to go to school or to pick up your, I believe it was your son, right, at school?
Yes.
Is that right? Yeah. Is that your only child, or do you have more than one?
No, I have my son, Nicholas. He'll be, will be four on December 5th, and then I have twin girls, Riley and Reagan. They'll be a year old on actually the end of this month, October 28th. So I have three kids, and we live right here by Belmont in Floral Park, and just everything, family. Have a great family. They all love the horses. My wife Jenny, she loves to come out to the races. So, it's been a great experience for everybody just to have some success. And it's a good, my son Nicholas, he loves coming to the races. Everybody at the racetrack knows him. He's only, like I said, he's only 4 years old. So I have a feeling he's heading down the same path, but he has to go to college.
Yeah, I was going to say, maybe a future trainer. Would you encourage him to make that step and follow in your footsteps?
Like I said, I think he's got to go to college. And I think if once he goes through that experience of, being in that kind of environment and he still wants to do it, then I think at that point you just got to try to help him in any way you can. But I would definitely, that's one thing I do, not that I'm happy, I'm very happy with what I ended up doing, but I do wish I would have had maybe some more of that experience, just the college years and instead of jumping right into this. I still think I would have eventually ended up doing it anyway, but that is one thing I would want him to do, is just to experience more and see that side of things before he makes the decision on what he wants to do.
Well, Bruce, we'll let you go do what you need to do. We certainly appreciate you being here tonight on Trainer Talk. It's been a lot of fun to hear your story. It's really flown by. All of our guests who appear on Trainer Talk receive gifts from a couple of our sponsors, EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strip. So we will get those to you. And again, can't thank you enough for being here with us tonight.
All right, no problem. Thank you.
All right, all the best. Bruce Brown joining us here on Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton. Merrill Shearer is going to be here in the second half of the program, so we will get to a break. We'll come back and we'll hear Merrill's story coming up next. This is Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network.
Success at the October sale continues in 2013 with Grade 1 winners Golden Sense and Admiral Kitten. In 5 years, graded success at home and abroad. Two Kentucky Derby winners. Graded stakes winning graduates at North America's most prestigious tracks, including Golden Sense winning the 2013 Grade 1 Santa Anita Derby. With over 1,000 yearlings, the October sale continues to offer outstanding performance and great value. The October sale, Fasig Tipton Lexington. Where will you be?
EPO Equine, the all-natural, healthy, safe, and legal blood builder, would like to extend a special congratulations to Nick and Martha Gonzalez and the entire team of this year's Queen's Plate winner, Midnight Aria, as well as Tony Alanya and all the connections of the remarkable Captain Treacherous, winner of the Metro and Meadowlands Pace. To learn more about how EPO Equine can help your equine athlete reach its true potential, contact Joe Valente at 215-501-6880 or visit EPOEquine.com.
You can be a better bettor just by knowing how a horse is working.
For the first time ever, RacingWithBruno.com's reports are available straight from the source.
Racing with Bruno's With the Works takes you behind the past performances into the morning routines that matter most.
With over 20 years of experience, our team of analysts specialize in first-time starters and layoff horses, as well as full card workout reports and selections.
Go to RacingWithBruno.com.
Now with the works.
I'm here with Dr. Jim Chiappetta from Flair, maker of Flair Equine Nasal Strips. Jim, how do Flair strips, when applied to a horse's nose, help protect their lungs?
Mike, studies show that 90% of the resistance to airflow in exercising horses is in the upper airway, with the majority of that being in the nose. When exercising at high intensity, many horses can bleed into their lungs. The strips have been shown to reduce that bleeding by reducing the resistance to airflow through the nasal passages. This keeps horses healthy by keeping their lungs healthier during performance and training.
To learn more, visit flairstrips.com.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to racehorsereport.com. Make racehorsereport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
racehorsereport.com.
Thursday evenings, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, is the Briznet.com call-in show. It's your chance to call in and let the Horse Racing Radio Nation know what's on your mind. Call us at 888-966-HRRN. That's 888-966-4776. And discuss the topics you choose in the world of thoroughbred racing. The Briznet.com call-in show, every Thursday, 6 to 7 p.m. Eastern, on Sirius Channel 93, or streaming live online at horseracingradio.com. This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live, presented by Basic Tipton.
Welcome back to the second half of Trainer Talk here on the Horse Racing Radio Network, all presented by Phasic Tipton. Mike Penna with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios, and a very fun visit with trainer Bruce Brown in the first half of the program. Really looking forward to our guest here coming up in the second half. That's trainer Merrill Shearer. We will talk to Merrill in just a minute, but want to remind you that Woodbine is coming out with a brand new wager, the Jackpot High Five. The Jackpot High Five is a bet where the bettor must select the top five finishers in a race in the correct order with one twist. There is a full pool plus a jackpot carryover that will pay out if and when only one single winning ticket exists. If multiple winning tickets exist, 50% of the today's pool will be paid as consolation, and the remainder will be added into the carryover pool if no winners exist. The full pool will be added to the carryover for the next available pool. And if that all sounds a bit confusing, don't be. Visit woodbineentertainment.com/jackpothighfive to learn more. It's a great wager, the Jackpot High Five. The carryover will continue to grow until a single ticket wins. There is a 20-cent bet minimum option as well. And how about this? A low takeout of 15%. You can learn more at woodbineentertainment.com/jackpothighfive. Trainer Merrill Shearer has conditioned, well, at least 1,328 winners in a stellar career. And that, I say at least, because that is since statistics started being kept by Equine Line in 1976. So his number's probably a bit higher than that because he's been at it since the early 1960s. He has purse earnings of well in excess of $22 million, and the native of Louisiana, nice enough to spend some time with us here on Trainer Talk today. Merrill, thanks for taking the time.
Thank you.
Happy to have you with me. And you told me yesterday when I called you that the last thing you wanted to talk about was yourself because people already know too much about you. But I guess when you've been doing this for more than 50 years, that kind of comes with the territory.
Oh, boy. I don't care about knowing about the horses. It's the rest of my life I'm worried about.
Well, 50 years is an incredible time to do anything. Certainly the same thing over and over, but you've done it very well, and it's been a great career for you. How did you first get interested in thoroughbred racing?
Oh, my father used to go to the track and in the fairgrounds in the early, well, I shouldn't say the early 40s. I'm sure he did. I wasn't around too much to go then. But I went in 48 was the first time I remember going and getting a picture, and I got that thing sitting here, and I guess I should blame him for me being in this business, which I truly did love at one time. It's a little harder now because of the labor situation, and I don't think the medication has nothing to do with me working. It's just what kind of labor you got to hire nowadays. They're not horsemen is what they are, and I shouldn't say this because, I mean, some of them grooms are good, but most of them are just laborers.
Well, I'd imagine the game has changed tremendously. The training game has changed tremendously since you first got involved in the early 1960s.
Well, the horses used to run 30 times a year or more. Now they don't run 30 times in their life. And I don't know. We were rubbing three back then in the mid-50s. And golly, you'd start at four and wouldn't be done in 11. Now these guys are rubbing four, and they started five, and they'd done at nine.
Yep.
It's to work on their legs.
Now, what have you had to do to adjust to the changes in the game over the past 50 years as you've gone through your career?
I don't know if I did adjust. I yell every day at them. You can't get a guy to, you'll never see a groom with dirt on their knees or sitting underneath. It's all paint now and poultice to make sure that they're done. As far as what they old saying is, slap and wrap is what they do now. And the medicine is to be rubbed. That's the thing, and they don't do it. It's a gone art, I guess.
Well, you know, you don't stay in the same profession for 50 years unless you're truly in love with it. And I know you have a tremendous passion for horse racing. What was it that first captured you about thoroughbred racing?
Oh, I don't know. Like I said, my dad took me out there when I was nine. And I don't know why he knew this trainer, but his name was Ralph Hughes or Howard. There was two, not the Hughes with the automobile, with the airplanes, but the Hugheses. And I don't know, they had an old horse, 10 years old, and he'd put me on him and let me walk around the shed row. He just followed the horse in front of him. And then all of a sudden, one day, the horse in front of him went to the track to gallop, and I was walking down the street with the daggum horse. They missed me coming around, and I saw the lights ever since then. You know, we moved from the Irish Channel out to Lakeview, and they didn't have very many houses, one a block. And so I had a horse, and I tied it, old riding pony, I guess you want to call it. I don't even know what it was. And then ride that thing all the day, all the time up to Levy, and ride him into the Lake Poncha train. And then I started liking it. And like I said, I went with him every Saturday and Sunday to the track. So that's how it went.
When did you finally decide that, or when did you know that you wanted to train horses for a living?
Well, you know, I don't know if it was train as much as I just wanted to be out there because I enjoyed it. And I got on a bus right out of school when I was 16 and went to Cleveland, Ohio for Boyd Littrell. And boy, it seemed like it took 2 days to get there by a bus then.
Yeah.
And I stayed up there all summer, and I told my mom I was going to go to night school when I come home, which I did, but I didn't like it. So I quit. I had one more year of school to go. I don't know if I'd have been any smarter than I am now if I went one more year anyway. I don't even know if I'm smart now that I said that.
So that was at 16. When did you first start training? And was that your first job, was a trainer, or did you have other jobs?
I was walking huts for Boyd Littrell in Cleveland. And then I went to New England in 59 with Buck Harper, a Canadian trainer. And I didn't like New England that much at that time, which I did not do now. They had four tracks running, plus all the fairs. We didn't hit too many fairs. But anyway, then I went back with Littrell. And I took my license out. I think, don't quote me. I want to say I was 21 or maybe 22. So that would have been 62 maybe.
Okay. And probably around the age of 20 or in your early 20s, I would imagine?
Yes. Well, I only had one old horse I get $400 for.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, when you first started on your own, did you have many horses, or it was just that
no,
one?
No, I had one. I was still working for somebody else, taking care of my own horse.
But that must have been a challenge to get started like that.
It was. I remember his name was Wooded Acres.
And when did he get a victory for you? Was he the horse?
Oh, yeah, he did. Yes, he did. He went, I took him back to Jefferson Downs. I guess it was, I couldn't even pay the van, but the guy on the van made my grandmother be out there with the money to pay when the van horse got off the van.
Wow. So you start with the one horse, and now you've grown into this tremendous operation. You've had so many years of success in the business. What was your first big break that kind of got you started?
I would imagine Sheriff Irwin, Red Irwin in Louisiana. You know, I'd have maybe 6 or 8 horses at the most. And then he wound up having all them Louisiana breeds. And I don't remember what year that was, but it might have been 70, maybe 70, mm-hmm. 69, something back in there. And, you know, he had all the equipment in the farm, and we went across the lake, and I stayed over there until we shipped in the run, and that's how he gave me the biggest break, because I went from, like I said, 6 to maybe 26. And you got the Louisiana program, which I think is as good a program there as there is for money and breeders to stay in the game.
Yeah, and you know, Merrill, you've always kind of made your mark in the Midwest and the Southeast, and it seems to me like you've always been very comfortable competing on that stage. And did you ever try to, I know you've been to Saratoga the last several years, but did you ever try to think about branching out and going other places, or were you quite comfortable in the Midwest?
Oh, well, Chicago was very good to me, but I don't know what happened to Chicago lately. You know, it's when Sportsman was running, that was everybody's racetrack. You know, the poor guy would be in there and he'd get a lot of money. Now the poor guy wins there and he's still poor.
Yeah. 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 It's a whole different game in Chicago now than it used to be, for sure.
Right.
So you make the decision a few years ago to go to Saratoga. That was a
well,
big step.
You know what? I don't know what got my head into that. I went there, in 73, I drove down from Boston over there and the Watch Onion, and I didn't go to Watch Onion, but I mean, Onion wound up winning. And that was so big, that place that year then, that they had people in the center field. I've never seen people in the center field before.
Wow.
And they had them in the center field there when he went, because they put boards down to walk across the track. And then I went back, maybe 8 years ago, just to visit, because I was at Del Mar, and I went out there, and then I went over there, flew there, and I went to Canada with a horse, and I said, man, I wouldn't mind putting this little 5 weeks in here with a few horses. And then it was all right, and I like the barn I got. I mean, it's nobody wants it, but I like it because it's mine, and I don't want a little corner. But when it rained, nobody wanted any barn there, really. But it's good. It's a good spot.
Yeah, and you've had success. You've been very successful the past few years at Saratoga.
Yeah, they blanked me 1 year up there, and they disqualified me one, too. And
yeah, you still haven't gotten over that DQ, have you?
I have not, no. Well, because I didn't think he should have come down, but no, who does think they should come down?
You know, not many trainers can say that their family is as intimately involved with racing as yours is. You have your sons, Richie and Gary, both trainers, and I can imagine as a father, that has to be extremely rewarding for you to see them follow in your footsteps.
Well, it wasn't for their mother, let me put it that way, but yeah, I like it, and they love the business, both of them. And I got another son, Eric, he's on the starting gate at Kingland. And I got one, Clay. I hate to say I got one. I have another son. I should have said Clay. He's working for Hillendale. And there's 6 sons. And one's in Shreveport. He doesn't have nothing to do with the horses much. I mean, he goes there, but he doesn't. And the other one's still in college, which he's been at forever. He's been there longer than most of the professors.
Talking with Merrill Scherer here on Trainer Talk, presented by Phasic Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. What do you remember about the day that Richie and Gary approached you and said, "Hey, Dad, we want to do exactly what you're doing"?
Well, to be truthful, I don't think they did. I used to bring them out when they were like, they're 2 years apart. I would say they were like maybe 6 and 8 or 7 and 9, something like that. And everybody else was getting, I think, maybe $2 a horse, and I'd give them $1. They didn't like the money. And I said, "Well, I don't feed the other guys. I'm feeding y'all." They thought I was cheap. And they probably were right, but... And they didn't want to come out too much after that.
Well, you know, it's funny, because I worked with my dad for a long time as well, and I can remember that as much as I enjoyed it, there were a lot of times as I was growing up that we butted heads because I thought I always knew more. Was it the same situation with you and the kids, or did it go relatively
not
smooth?
Not at all. No, I've never had that on this thing. You know, maybe they hour when they lose their $2, you know, what the heck, what happened to that horse? I said, "That's why you don't tell people."
Yeah.
You know, if you knew when they'd win, you don't need what do you need? That's like the same thing, and I tell everybody that, well, the sheets got you on top. I said, if that guy knew what he was doing, he wouldn't tell his information. He'd bet his health.
Right. What's the biggest thing that you tried to teach them as they were hanging out around the barn and growing up around the operation?
To my sons?
Yeah.
You said?
Yeah.
Well, you got to be on top of it. You got to be hands-on. There's no way that you can sit in the grandstand and expect somebody to do what you want done. Even I used to walk a horse until now. I can't walk hardly, but I can walk, but I can't walk 30 minutes straight and up and down that shed row. But if you don't watch what them guys are doing, they're not going to do a job. They just, there's no more, like I started this thing off, there's no more work ethic. They're just slap and wrap, paycheck and go eat, or depends on which ones you got. Some of them just gamble it all. I'd rather have the gambler work for me than the one that sends the money home.
Yeah, I don't blame you. And I read somewhere that the thing that you have always prided yourself on and really tried to instill in the kids as they were growing up was just to be honest, and especially with the owners, because that's so important. And we've heard a lot of trainers on this program, Merrill, say the very same thing.
Well, as far as honesty, I'm going to tell you a true story, and this sounds bad, but it happened to me. And this was, like I told you, I had one horse, and I had a guy coming by. He wanted to buy half a horse with me. And I shouldn't tell this story, but it was a long, long time ago, like in the early 60s. So we bought him for $375, and we went to Warner Park and run him, and he was third. Well, I told the guy we bought him for $700, so he bought the whole horse, and he pulled up bad. He says, "Don't worry about it, Merrill. I'll get rid of the horse." So he went back to the same guy, and he asked the guy for $375 for the half. And he said, "You only paid me $375 for the whole horse." So I got nailed, and that was the end of that.
Oh, yeah, because it eventually comes back to get you, doesn't it?
Yes, all the time. Somebody will get you. So I said, I can't remember. I got a terrible memory, and it's worse now. But that was the end of that, trying to do something.
Well, you know, you had a day, December 7th of 2008, that you achieved an extremely rare feat at the fairgrounds. Yourself, Richie, and Gary all saddled a winner on the same card. That had to be just an incredible day for you and for the kids.
Yeah, it was. Of course, they wrote it up in the paper that I had the cheapest horse in the race. I don't know why they had to do that. They could have just left the coat to all win the race. But, you know, I win the cheapest claim, and they win allowance or high claim. But it was. And it's a big, I don't know. And I was trying to think of whom else could have done that, you know, in the country. You know, and I was trying to just remember from way back of people who had kids that were training. And it would have took a lot of kids, you know, at least two more that's training anyway. And I couldn't come up with anybody, but maybe a really, because he used to be in Detroit, and who had a family or one of the Bairds, but I don't think I couldn't figure out what other family could have done that. I really don't.
Now, I don't know if that's ever, I mean, it maybe has happened before, but I can't off the top of my head recall another time when you had three family members like that, a father and two sons, saddle winners in the same card.
I really don't know. And I, like I said, I tried and I don't know. I hope it's a record, really. I don't know what it would do with it, but I mean, it would be something to talk about.
Yeah, it's a great story to tell. Trainer Merrill Shearer joining us on Trainer Talk, presented by Fasig Tipton on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Merrill, when you look back over your career, there's going to be moments that stand out to you. There's going to be horses that stand out to you. Talk about a few of those moments and those horses that have come through your barn that you're just never going to forget.
Oh, gosh. You know, I've never had a real good one or even an expensive horse. I had a horse called, I probably was the most prestigious horse with a little horse called Little Bro Landis. You know, was claimed for 12.5. We went over 800,000 with him, and that was in the mid '80s. Or he was, I think it was an '83 model. He might be 30 now, but maybe a little later. Maybe it was an '85, but he wasn't much older. And I had that Truxton. We claimed for 10, and J.O. Moe was training all them horses for them big people down there. And we run him in the stake at the fairgrounds, and I run. Can't remember his horse name right now. I run hidden with him all the way to the head of the lane, and I wound up third, and he was fourth. And boy, he come down to see that jock. Who the hell was that cheap horse run me in the ground? I shot and got in the corner. I was afraid he might hit me. But, I mean, there were several, you know, like I said, I've never had nobody give me a horse or even have a horse that somebody that, well, Mr. Heath, I shouldn't say that, Centaur Farms. He had quite a few good ones, but I didn't get him to start off with. I might have got that one mare, Myriad, and Fiery Dancer that they sold big money in the sales, you know. But as far as me getting a client that said, well, here's one that's worth $500,000 by every horse in my barn.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about claiming horses for $10,000 and then moving them up and getting them, you know, maybe even to a stakes race level after a claim like that. Is it more rewarding, Merrill, to claim a horse and turn him around and put all that work in? You mentioned being hands-on. To put that kind of work in and turn him around, is it maybe a little bit more rewarding with a horse like that than it is to have somebody give you a horse that you know is supposed to be a good horse?
Well, you know, I've never even given that a thought, because when I claim, which I haven't done very much of lately because we've been breeding so many and going to the sales, I usually just hope I can do as good as the guy that did that we take him from. Or if he wasn't doing any good, I wouldn't have took him or somebody else either. So, you know, they had an old training. The guy just reminded me the other day. He said, Logan Fisher, he said, if you run a horse four times and he ain't win, hasn't won, you're running him in the wrong spot. And he's probably right. So it's a hard game to go. I mean, there's so many ups and downs. And, you know, and I never entertained in my life running horse in the Derby. Not that I wouldn't want to do it, but I know I don't get them kind. And the closest thing I come to the Derby was bringing a horse over after Tim Tam win, picking up the roses that was falling off the thing and giving them to the people in the grandstand.
So what would be your personal career highlight if you had to choose one thing?
Well, it's hard to, you know, because I don't want to hurt any other owners that I have. I'm only down to three anyway, and I own part of them. But, I mean, they never had them kind. I want to say when I ran in Arlington Million and with Little Bro Landis, a mile and a half, he couldn't go that far. But it was just a thing for the party the day before that Mr. Duchess Schwab had, and That's a first-class outfit, and I still got the bottle of champagne in there. It's engraved in there. I guess the stuff's hard as a rock. I never even look inside. But I got that in the card they give you, and the blooms and everything. It was an amazing thing to go to that party that night. And the other people that were in there, you know, they had Lure, of course. He come out because the track got real heavy, and that was my only horse, if there was a downfall. He was such a big horse. He weighed 1,200 pounds in a heavy track going a mile and a half. He just wore himself out on it.
Yeah, and you had another horse that I really liked, Atticus Christie, who was grade three winner, right?
Yeah, he was a very nice horse. I ran him for 2,500, and I don't know what happened. Amos told me he had a claim in front of him. He changed his mind. Boy, was I glad of that. But he was very good, and Mr. Heath raised him, and I had the full assistant to him, Fiery Dancer, like I told you. And but Mr. Heath doesn't race too many anymore. I guess he's up in age. I hate to use that word because he's 10 years older than me, but he just has a couple of mares left, and whatever he doesn't sell, he races. And being as he's racing and breeding in Florida, mostly they don't come up north. They stay in the Florida program. But Atticus Christie was my pet. Man, he would take forever to get to the track. He'd stop and look at everything. And then after he was claimed twice, and Brett Calhoun had him last, and he was pulling up sore. And I said, when you finish, I'll buy him. He said, no, the man said, give him to you. So I put the pony saddle on the son of a gun. He wouldn't stand still no more. He wanted to get out there and run off. So I wasn't getting on him. So I told the guy, put the exercise saddle, and he'll just stand. And that's what he wanted, just stand. He was a pet. He really was.
It's amazing how attached you get to some of these horses, and I'm sure you've had several over the years that really, really kind of captured you and horses that you're just, for whatever reason, you know, never going to forget, even if they weren't big stakes horses.
Oh yeah, it doesn't have to be a good horse to like them. I got one, oh God, I can't remember, but in 1965, I think it was, I ran a December 23rd and she went, and run a December 25th and she run and win at the fairgrounds. It was named after my mom, Ruby's Market. Went 2 times in 3 days. The test wasn't even back from the first one I ran.
Wow. Wow. That's a great story. Merrill, just a minute or two left before we do have to wrap things up, but curious what you enjoy doing outside of racing when you have an opportunity to be away from the barn or be with the family. What other types of things do you enjoy?
Oh, boy, you're going to really get me in trouble here. I like sitting drinking a few Bud Lights. They may send me a horse Bud Light.
Hey, there's nothing wrong with that.
No, it's very good. As long as you get up in the morning, which I do, I don't miss a day. I missed some last few days. I had a little, I don't know what I had, high blood pressure or something got me. I was sick as a dog for 3 days, but I'm over it now.
Well, we're glad you're back on your game and looking forward to seeing more winners from the Merrill Shearer Barn and looking forward to seeing you when you make your way back over to Keeneland here again. But I want to say thank you for joining us here tonight, Merrill. It's been a great visit. I know you said you weren't thrilled to be talking about yourself, but let me tell you, it was so enjoyable.
Yeah, that's all I talked about.
Amazing, isn't it?
It is. I'll get some more information. We'll talk about something else if you have a call.
All right, there we go. Merrill,
okay,
thank you so much
for having me.
All right, thank you. Merrill Shearer joining us here on Trainer Talk presented by Phasic Tipton. Merrill, like all of our guests, going to receive gifts from our good friend Joey Diamond at EPO Equine and Dr. Jim Chiapetta and the great folks at Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll get those over to Merrill. Want to remind everybody that if you did miss any portion of that interview with Merrill Shearer or with Bruce Brown in the first half of the program, you can go to our website later on this evening for a podcast. It's all at horseracingradio.com. horseracingradio.net and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. We are back tomorrow from 3 to 7 Eastern Time with our HRN live coverage. This hour will be the BrisNet.com call-in show. On Friday, we're here from 3 to 7 with the Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview as our 6 to 7 feature on Friday afternoons to get you ready for all the big racing this weekend. And of course, on Saturday, we bring you the Equine Forum from 8 to 10 a.m. and then our coverage of the QE2 Challenge Cup from Keeneland on Saturday afternoon. You can visit our website, horseracingradio.net, to listen online and to see a complete schedule with SiriusXM channel information and listing of affiliates. It's all there at horseracingradio.net. For our special guests here tonight, Bruce Brown and Merrill Shearer, want to say a very special thank you to them. For our producer, Lee Delapina, I am Mike Penna, and we will talk to you tomorrow on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Thanks for listening to Trainer Talk presented by Fasig Tipton.